Hello, this is Randy Thompson sitting in for George Douglas. Welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Services, the Week magazine, which offers the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's reading is from the issue, which is dated July 19th, 2013. For the next hour, I shall be reading articles from these nine sections of the Week magazine, starting with the section called The Main Stories, and running through these sections: Controversy of the Week, Good Week 4, Bad Week 4, People, Briefing, Best Columns in the U.S., The Last Word, and ending with the Talking Points section. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. So we start out then with the main stories and how they were covered. Egypt in chaos as the military seizes control. What happened? Egypt's brief experiment with democracy was on the verge of collapse this week after the military ousted the country's Islamist president and security forces shot dead at least 51 of his Muslim Brotherhood supporters. As Islamist demonstrators staged a sit-in outside a military building where they believed President Mohamed Morsi was being held, government soldiers began shooting into the crowd. "They opened fire on us while we were praying," said one protester. "They are criminals." Security officers said they only responded after a terrorist group tried to storm the building and issued an arrest warrant for Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed Badi, claiming he had incited the riot. The military overthrew the government on July 3 after at least 14 million Egyptians and as many as 30 million staged anti-Morsi protests in cities around the country, perhaps the largest protest in world history. The protesters, many of them secular and young, objected to the Muslim Brotherhood's strong-arm governance and Morsi's failure to revive a broken economy. This week, the interim government attempted to reassure Egyptians and the world about its democratic intentions, but unveiling a plan to amend the country's Islamist authored constitution and hold elections within 6 months. The Muslim Brotherhood rejected the roadmap and called on Egyptians to, quote unquote, rise up against those who want to steal their revolution with tanks and armored vehicles. What the editorial said. "There is no ambiguity about what happened in Egypt," said the Washington Post. "A president who won 51% of the vote in a free and fair election was ousted and arrested by soldiers on orders of generals. That, by definition, is a military coup. So why is President Obama defying the federal law that requires the U.S. to cut off aid to any nation where there's a military coup? If the U.S. truly believes in democracy, we must suspend our $1.3 billion in aid unless the generals prove the new elections will include all peaceful political forces, including the Muslim Brotherhood. Ending aid to Egypt would be a huge mistake," said the Wall Street Journal. "The Obama administration has never exerted any real influence over Egypt, failing to persuade Mubarak to institute even modest democratic reforms, and then failing to restrain Morsi when he tried to build an Islamist dictatorship. The U.S. now has a second chance to use its leverage to shape a better outcome, but if Obama cuts our only source of influence with the generals, we won't be able to stop them from reinstituting a Mubarak-style military dictatorship." What the columnist said. Morsi's downfall has proved once again that Islamist ideology is incompatible with democracy, said Michael Hirsch in NationalJournal.com. Morsi, the first elected Islamist head of state in Arab history, forced through an unpopular Sharia-inspired constitution, cracked down on women's rights, and arrested opposition activists who dared oppose his will. Outraged by Morsi's authoritarianism, millions of Egyptians issued their own declaration of independence by demanding his removal. The generals rightly intervened on their behalf. Popular or not, the coup sends a dangerous message, said Shadi Hamid in the New York Times. Islamists across the Middle East who renounced terrorism and sought change through politics will now ask, with good reason, whether democracy has anything to offer them. Many may decide that the radicals are right and that change can't come through democracy. Of unbelievers, violence is the only path. Morsi was ousted primarily because of his incompetence, not his Islamic ideology, said Evelyn Gordon in CommentaryMagazine.com. He did nothing to reverse a 33% unemployment rate, revive the ailing tourist industry, or tackle fuel shortages or soaring inflation. And if the next government can't solve those economic issues, it'll face similar mass protests. No political party in Egypt, not the liberals or the Islamists, has a serious proposal on how to revive Egypt's economy, said Walter Russell Mead in TheAmericanInterest.com. But Egypt must be governed, even if it can't be governed well. So the next stage of Egypt's revolution will be the construction of a government without hope. Right now, the army is the only institution capable of this task. When hope fades, force is what remains. The fatal crash of a 777. Investigators focused this week on pilot error as the cause of Asiana Airlines' plane crash at San Francisco Airport, which killed two passengers and injured 180, some of them with serious spinal injuries. The Boeing 777 en route from Seoul approached the runway far too slowly, almost stalling as it lost altitude, then struck a seawall before slamming into the runway. Two teenage girls from China died. One may have been run over by a rescue vehicle. The two pilots were both experienced, but one was still training on the 777, and the other was making his first flight as an instructor. The big mystery of Flight 214 is why in God's name did these two pilots sit there and allow the airspeed to get so low, said former TWA pilot Barry Schiff. Frequent flyers will be understandably troubled by this catastrophe, said Arnold Barnett in CNN.com. But crashes are exceedingly rare in this country. These two deaths are the first in more than 3 billion passenger journeys taken on scheduled commercial flights since 2009. A child born in the U.S. today is far more likely to grow up to be president than to die in a plane crash. And these kinds of accidents are now survivable, said John Burnett in NPR.org. Look at the Asiana 777's gutted and charred fuselage, and you wonder how anyone made it out alive. But airlines now use fire-resistant materials and carpeting and build seats able to withstand 16 G's of force. Stewards were trained to evacuate the plane in 90 seconds, and fire squads were on the scene in minutes. But while flying has become safer, human beings still fly the plane, said USA Today in an editorial. And the initial evidence suggests pilot error may be to blame. Did the pilots put too much trust in technology to guide them to safety, or too little? Minimizing human error might be the only way to make this extraordinarily safe activity even safer. And then there's this article, The Zimmerman Trial Winds Up. As the murder trial of George Zimmerman headed for the jury this week, prosecutors portrayed the former neighborhood watch captain as a wannabe cop with a gun who provoked a fight with unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin, while defense witnesses backed Zimmerman's account that he shot Martin while the 17-year-old sat on his chest punching him. Zimmerman told police that he had stopped following Martin and was headed back to his SUV when the teen attacked him, hitting him repeatedly and slamming his head into the pavement. Prosecutor Richard Manti argued that inconsistencies in Zimmerman's account showed that he acted maliciously from the start and concocted a self-defense story. There are two people involved here. One of them is dead, and one of them is a liar. Manti said, but forensic pathologist Vincent DeMaio, testifying for the defense, said that the wounds revealed that Zimmerman had received blunt force trauma to the head, and that Martin was on top of Zimmerman when he was shot. The odds of George Zimmerman being convicted of second-degree murder are hurtling towards zero, said Mark I. Pinsky in HuffingtonPost.com. DeMaio nailed it for the defense when he testified that Martin was leaning forward over Zimmerman when he was shot, and that Zimmerman's wounds were consistent with having his head slammed against concrete. Witnesses also testified that Martin was on top when Zimmerman fired. If Zimmerman walks, says Roxanne Jones in CNN.com, it will be deeply troubling to people in the black community. Martin was a black teen who was walking home when Zimmerman targeted him. What did he do to deserve an execution? One witness said it was Martin who was pinned to the ground, at least at first. Either way, when an unarmed child is confronted and gunned down in the street by a grown man, that's murder. We'll never know what happened that night down in Florida, said Jim Gergity in NationalReview.com. All we'll ever have is a he-said, dispute that we're supposed to line up and take sides over. But for Zimmerman to be convicted of second-degree murder, the prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he acted with hatred and an indifference to human life. That's a very high bar. And finally, we have this on this page, the main stories. When Claire Johnson, 50, took her C&I dog, Venice, to training classes in Stoke-on-Trent, England, the canine helper quickly became friends with fellow student Rod, owned by 52-year-old Mark Gaffey. As the two dogs became inseparable pals, their sight-impaired owners struck up a friendship that soon turned to romance. Now, after an 11-month courtship, Johnson and Gaffey are to marry, with Venice and Rod leading them to the altar. They are as much a couple as me and Mark, said Johnson. They will be walking us down the aisle and be ring-bearers. This wedding is down to them. And that takes us to Controversy of the Week. And we have this story. Obamacare, is the program already in trouble? We always knew the Affordable Care Act would be a disaster, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But with 6 months before most of it even takes effect, President Obama's signature accomplishment is already becoming a fiasco for the ages. In a clear attempt to bury bad news, the White House waited until the eve of the July 4th holiday to announce a one-year delay in the ACA's employer mandate, requiring businesses with more than 50 full-time employees to provide workers with health insurance. The White House and its defenders are downplaying the significance of this tactical retreat, said Yuval Levin in NationalReview.com. But given the political embarrassment it inevitably caused, it's a sign that Obamacare is in serious trouble. For 3 years, the administration has smugly denied Republican criticism that the giant health care bureaucracy at the heart of Obamacare is unworkable. Now that implementation draws near, the wheels are coming off the bus, and even the administration has been forced to admit it. Don't be fooled by the Obamacare train wreck doomsday saying chorus, said Jonathan Chait in NewYorkMagazine.com. The employer mandate is not a central aspect of the new system, and the administration delayed it until 2015 only to mollify companies who complained that providing their compliance was too burdensome. The vast majority of employers already do offer health insurance, so this delay means little and will affect only about 1% of the U.S. workforce. Introducing a program this big was always going to be bumpy, said USA Today. When the Bush administration expanded Medicare to include prescription drug coverage, the program got off to a very rough start and had to be fixed. Obamacare Central Reform remains on track for 2014, providing affordable health insurance through exchanges to the 50 million uninsured Americans. Those rooting for an Obamacare collapse would sentence these Americans to life without regular health care. Delaying the employer mandate was the right thing to do, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com, but it should be scrapped entirely. Since the mandate applies only to companies with more than 50 full-time employees, it provides a perverse incentive for companies close to that 50 work threshold not to hire anyone else, or to fire full-time employees and replace them with multiple part-timers. In a saner, less polarized political era, the White House and Congress would work together to fix the ACA as problems arose. But Republicans refused to pass any legislation that makes the law work better, because they want it to fail altogether. So the White House had no choice but to act unilaterally. Still, the admission that Obamacare still isn't ready for prime time will shake the public confidence, said Chicago Tribune. Many Americans have real doubts that the federal government can reliably manage something as complex and massive as the health care system, and a tough sell just got tougher. The real test is only a few months away, said Ruth Marcus in WashingtonPost.com. In October, the insurance exchanges are supposed to start making policies available to the currently uninsured. Will the exchanges be ready and offer policies uninsured people want and can afford? Will Americans in their 20s, the young invincibles who think they don't need health care, enroll in sufficient numbers to bring the insurer's cost and premiums down? Of all the headaches facing Obamacare, in other words, the employer mandate isn't close to the most throbbing. That takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Good Week 4, Bad Week 4, and Only in America. Well, it was a good week for fibbing after President Obama told a student reporter during a healthy eating event for kids that his favorite food is broccoli. And it was a good week for being number two after Mexico overtook the U.S. as the world's fattest nation. Thanks to a rapidly worsening diet of fizzy drinks and cheap fast food, 32.8% of Mexican adults are now classified as obese, compared with 31.8% of Americans. And it was a good week for potholes after a British ambulance racing to the hospital hit a large rut, throwing patient Ray Lee into the air. When Lee came down, the jolt reset his racing heartbeat from a potentially fatal 190 beats a minute to 60. The paramedic looked at me in disbelief, said Lee, 65. Lee said that he used to complain about local roads, but now I never want them to fill in another pothole. And it was a bad week for double daring. After Wanda Podgorski of California fled rather than face California charges of insurance fraud, taunting a prosecutor with a tweet reading, "Catch me if you can." Police used her Twitter account to trace her to Mexico, where she was arrested. And it was a bad week for multiculturalism after the New York Mets scheduled Native American Heritage Day on July 25 when they're playing the Atlanta Braves. After some contentious discussions between the team and a Native American organization, the event has been canceled. And it was a bad week for sparing the rod after an Oklahoma man who was noodling, catching fish with his bare hands, grabbed a hold of a cottonmouth snake After a week in the hospital and 14 doses of anti-venom, Destry Mitchell advised fellow noodlers, be careful. Only in America, rangers in Death Valley National Park are begging tourists to stop cracking eggs on the sidewalk. Daytime temperatures there have soared above 120 degrees, inspiring many visitors to try to fry eggs on the ground, leaving a mess for maintenance crews. If visitors must attempt egg frying, the ranger said, they should at least use a pan or tinfoil. And only in America, animal shelters in many U.S. cities are reporting a surge in the number of abandoned chickens. Tiffany Young, founder of a Seattle animal rescue group, says the problem is hipster urban yuppie types trying to raise poultry in their backyards and giving up when they realize it's hard work. There is not a sanctuary in the Northwest that is not at capacity or beyond, said Young. And that takes us to the section of the magazine entitled The U.S. at a Glance. And we have these stories from Crescent City, California, Boston, New York City, Lakeland, Florida, Austin, and Corona, California. From Crescent City, California, prison protest. Around 30,000 inmates in California's prisons kicked off what could be the largest prison protest in state history by refusing meals this week. Inmates in two-thirds of the state's 33 prisons refused breakfast and lunch on Monday to protest the state policy of holding some inmates in isolation indefinitely, sometimes for decades, because of their ties to prison gangs. Around 2,300 prisoners also refused to go to work or to their classes. The protest was organized by a small group of inmates at the Pelican Bay State Prison in Crescent City. Many of the inmates involved led a series of similar protests in California prisons 2 years ago, when more than 11,600 inmates went on a hunger strike. The Corrections Department will not acknowledge this week's protest as a hunger strike unless inmates have missed 9 consecutive meals. And from Boston, Tsarnaev pleads not guilty. Boston bombing suspect Devokar Tsarnaev this week made his first public appearance since his arrest, uttering the words not guilty 7 times in response to charges that he used a weapon of mass destruction to kill at the Boston Marathon in April. Wearing an orange prison jumpsuit and with his left hand in a cast, the 19-year-old fidgeted before entering the plea in federal court, turning to look at about 30 victims and family members who attended. Authorities say that Devokar and his now-dead older brother, Tamerlan, planted 2 bombs near the race's finish line, killing 3 people and wounding more than 260, and later killed MIT police officer Sean Collier. Prosecutors say Devokar wrote a confession before his capture, saying he planted the bombs in response to the U.S. killing of Muslim civilians. And from New York City, Spitzer is back. Former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, who resigned in a prostitution scandal 5 years ago, announced this week that he intends to run for comptroller in this fall's New York City elections. The crusading Democrat, who made his name prosecuting Wall Street firms as state attorney general, left politics in disgrace when it emerged that he had patronized prostitutes through a high-end escort service. "I'm hoping there will be forgiveness," said Spitzer this week. "I'm asking for it." If Spitzer secures the 3,750 signatures required to get on the ballot, one of his opponents will be Kristen Davis, an ex-madame who spent 3 months in prison for running an escort service that she claims supplied Spitzer with prostitutes. "This is going to be the funniest campaign ever," said Davis. "I've been waiting for my day to face Spitzer for 5 years." And from Lakeland, Florida, sex scandal. Nearly a dozen Lakeland Police Department employees, including some high-ranking officers, have been implicated in a series of alleged consensual and coerced sexual encounters with a civilian crime analyst in motels, patrol cars, and fire stations. A 59-page report by Polk County State Attorney Jerry Hill details Sue Eberle's accounts of sexual liaisons she felt forced into with officers on and off duty, including in the parking lot of a cemetery after the funeral of a slain cop. Hill said he could not prosecute the cases because too much time had passed since the alleged encounters and there was a lack of physical evidence. But an internal investigation is underway. Already, several employees have resigned, retired, or been placed on administrative leave. We find the conduct to be at best a waste of taxpayer dollars, wrote Hill. At worst, their actions indicate a moral bankruptcy. And from Austin, Texas, Perry for president? Texas Governor Rick Perry announced this week that he will not seek re-election next year, raising the possibility of a 2016 White House run. The time has come to pass on the mantle of leadership, the Republican governor said. Since taking over from George W. Bush in 2000, Perry has become the longest-serving governor in Texas history. Though his 2012 bid for the Republican presidential nomination crumbled, Perry said this week that another presidential run was an option. Perry's departure sets up the state's first open seat race for governor since 1990. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott looks likely to win the Republican nomination, though he is yet to declare his candidacy. Meanwhile, Democratic State Senator Wendy Davis, who recently rose to prominence by filibustering an abortion bill, has said she'll take a second look at the race. And finally, from Corona, California, comes this: inmates sterilized. As many as 248 female inmates at California prisons were sterilized without proper authorization between 1997 and 2010, according to a report published this week by the Center for Investigative Reporting. The report relies on state documents and interviews with former inmates at the California Institution for Women in Corona and the Valley State Prison for Women in Chowchilla, who claim that repeat offenders were coerced by prison medical staff into signing up for tubal ligation surgery while they were pregnant. Former Valley State Prison inmate Crystal Nguyen, who worked in the prison's infirmary, said she often overheard medical staff persuading inmates to be sterilized. "I was like, oh my God, that's not right," she said. "Do they think they're animals and they don't want to breed anymore?" State documents support the claims, revealing that in the years in question, California paid doctors $147,460 to perform sterilizations. You're listening to The Week magazine, and now we'll turn our attention to the sections entitled People and Briefing. The Years Nikki Lost. Stevie Nicks has given up on finding true love, said Jada Juan in New York Magazine. As the glamorous lead singer of Fleetwood Mac, she had a series of intense and tumultuous love affairs that included bandmates Mick Fleetwood and Lindsey Buckingham, Don Henley and Joe Walsh of the Eagles, and record producer Jimmy Iovine. "I had a lot of boyfriends and lots of fun," she said. "I had enough fun and enough relationships to last me for the rest of my life, really." When the run of relationships ended, Nix was prescribed a tranquilizer called Clonopin, which was supposed to help her kick her raging cocaine habit. The drug made her feel like a zombie, and she spent much of the next 8 years lying on her couch eating and watching TV. I'm happy not to be married, not to have children, says Nick, 65. But the fact is that I don't know what would have happened in that 8 years. Maybe I would have met somebody or had a baby. That was really stolen from me. Nick's quit Klonopin, but remains unattached. Like I'm going to go to a bar and hang out? I mean, where am I going to meet somebody? She pauses. If that special man walked into my life, I would probably pack up my bags and go with him. But love is a very elusive thing. Hammer's Wild Oats. Arnie Hammer doesn't miss his wild bachelor life, said Jessica Pressler in Elle. When the actor dropped out of high school to become an actor, he dove into Los Angeles' party scene. I'd grown up in a household of so much love, everything just felt wholesome, said Hammer, 26. Once I was on my own, I was like, let's see how hot this candle can burn. For the next 4 years, he gorged on drink, drugs, fast cars, and dangerous women. One chick tried to stab me when we were having sex. She was like, true loves leave scars, you don't have any. Then she tried to stab me with a butcher knife. Of course, I promptly broke up with her 7 months later. Hammer's tour of the wild side came to an end 5 years ago when he met his soulmate, TV journalist Elizabeth Chambers. The couple married 2 years later. Now that he's settled down with a woman with whom he has a real connection, Hammer sees his old life of endless parties and hookups as stressful and empty. It wasn't fun. Marriage is fun. Not to be graphic, he lowers his voice, but you can have sex and in the middle just start laughing about something totally funny. You can't do that with somebody you're dating. You're too nervous. That takes us to briefing, and here we have the article entitled The Middle East Wild Card. Hezbollah has helped turn the tide of war in Syria. What makes the Lebanese militia such a deadly fighting force? What is Hezbollah? It's a Shiite political movement, terrorist organization, and now freelance army dedicated to the destruction of Israel. Launched as a small terrorist group specializing in suicide bombings and kidnappings, Hezbollah now operates a state within a state in Lebanon. It has an army of 4,000 professional soldiers and thousands more reservists, propped up by the $700 million in cash and arms the group receives each year from Iran, its main sponsor. Tehran's money also funds Hezbollah's social service network. It runs dozens of hospitals and schools for needy Shiites, and its virtually anti-Israel satellite TV station, Al-Manar, the beacon. Hezbollah is an Iranian aircraft carrier parked north of Israel, said Paul Salem, director of Beirut Carnegie Middle East Center. You hit us, we hit you. That is what Hezbollah gets the big bucks and the missiles for. Hezbollah also works to undermine U.S. interests in the region and those of Sunni Muslim states. Thousands of Hezbollah troops are now fighting Sunni rebels while defending the regime of the group's other major patron, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. What are the group's origins? Hezbollah is a byproduct of the long-running conflict between Israel and Palestinian militants. In 1982, the Israeli Defense Forces poured into South Lebanon with the aim of destroying Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Liberation Organization, which had set up base in the country. But the region's largely Shia Muslim population, Lebanon's poorest and most downtrodden community, was caught in the crossfire. Stray bombs destroyed homes and killed farmers in their fields, leading angry Shiites to take up arms against Israel. When we entered Lebanon, there was no Hezbollah, said former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. It was our presence there that created Hezbollah. seeing an opportunity to export their Islamic revolution and strike a blow against Israel, the rulers of Shiite Iran provided military training to several Lebanese Shiite groups, which united under the name Hezbollah, or Party of God. What was Hezbollah's goal? To drive Israel out of Lebanon and establish an Islamic state in the country. The group waged a brutal guerrilla war against Israeli forces, and when Western peacekeepers arrived in the country, Hezbollah struck them as well. In April 1983, a suicide bomber hit the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, killing 63 people. 6 months later, a suspected Hezbollah operative drove a truck filled with the equivalent of 12,000 pounds of TNT into the U.S. Marine barracks in the capital, killing 241 American servicemen. President Ronald Reagan withdrew U.S. forces from Beirut soon thereafter, and in 1985, Israel pulled back to a sliver of territory along the Lebanese border. After a war-weary Israel pulled out of Lebanon altogether in 2000, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah hailed the retreat as the first Arab victory in the history of Arab-Israeli conflict. What makes Hezbollah effective? Its rigorous training and indoctrination process. Hezbollah clerics teach new recruits that jihad and martyrdom will bring them closer to God. The religious lessons are first, said one recruiter. Religion first, before you even see a gun. Would-be fighters are then sent on punishing marches through Lebanon's wild mountains, instructed in urban and rural combat, and taught how to fire everything from M16 assault rifles to anti-tank missile launchers. The result of that grueling training were apparent during Hezbollah's 2006 war with Israel, when its soldiers fought their better-armed opponents to a bloody stalemate. Hezbollah is by far the greatest guerrilla group in the world, Israeli Brigadier General Guy Zur said at the end of the 34-day conflict. Why did Hezbollah intervene in Syria? Nasrallah views Syria's rebels not as freedom fighters battling to remove a dictator, but as Sunni extremists trying to oust Assad, because he is an Alawite, an offshoot of Shia Islam. There is also a logistical reason for Hezbollah's intervention. The group relies on Syria to act as a conduit for arms and money from Iran. If that supply line were severed, Hezbollah would no longer challenge Israel militarily or fund its state within a state. Have its fighters helped Assad? Yes, enormously. Hezbollah fighters are better trained in guerrilla and urban combat than Assad's forces, and their willingness to engage in fierce fighting in rebel strongholds has forced the opposition to retreat. In recapturing the strategic city of Qusair from the rebels, we went from room to room, from house to house, from window to window, said one Hezbollah squad leader. But the group's support for Assad's crackdown has come at a cost, damaging Hezbollah's reputation in the Arab world as a champion of the underdog. Being engaged in a civil war on a foreign, albeit neighboring, land is a different fight from dying defending your village, family, and honor against an Israeli occupier, said Rhonda Slim, a scholar at the Washington-based Middle East Institute. When will the first mother in black, who has already lost one son fighting in Qusair, refuse to send her second and third sons to fight in Syria? And there's this inserted box article in that same page of briefing entitled Hezbollah's Boy Scouts. Hezbollah likes to get its recruits young. From age 6, Lebanese Shiite boys can enroll in the group's youth wing, the Mahdi Scouts. The youngsters wear Boy Scout-style uniforms and kerchiefs, and much of what they do is similar to the activities of scouts the world over, learning to swim, building campfires, and tying knots. But the religious and moral lessons the kids are taught couldn't be more different. A scouting manual for 12 to 14-year-olds contains chapters entitled, Know Your Enemy, and Facts About Jews, which describe Jews as cruel, cowardly, corrupt, and deceitful. Books for younger scouts contain puzzles with militant themes, such as a bearded Hezbollah fighter at the start of the maze with an Israeli bunker at the far end. A 10-year-old boy called Ahmed explained to Foreign Policy what he'd learned in the scouts. "I've learned to make weapons out of paper," he said. "I asked the Mahdi scouts to let me prepare to become a real fighter." And that takes us to the part of the magazine entitled The Last Word. And we have this article, Glorifying the Civil War. "The war ended slavery," says Tony Horowitz, "but was the slaughter of 750,000 Americans really necessary?" This article originally appeared in The Atlantic magazine. In early July, on the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, pilgrims will crowd Little Round Top and the high watermark of Pickett's Charge. But venture beyond these famous shrines to battlefield valor, and you'll find quiet sights like Iverson's Pits, which recall the inglorious reality of Civil War combat. On July 1, 1863, Alfred Iverson ordered his brigade of North Carolinians across an open field. The soldiers marched in tight formation until Union riflemen suddenly arose from behind a stone wall and opened fire. 500 rebels fell dead or wounded on a line as straight as a dress parade, Iverson reported. "They nobly fought and died without a man running to the rear. No greater gallantry and heroism has been displayed during this war." Soldiers told a different story, of being sprayed by the brains of men shot in front of them or hugging the ground and waving white kerchiefs. An artilleryman described one row of 79 North Carolinians executed by a single volley, their dead feet perfectly aligned. The living rolled the dead into shallow trenches, hence the name Iverson's Pits, now a grassy expanse more visited by ghost hunters than battlefield tourists. This and other scenes of unromantic slaughter aren't likely to get much notice during the Gettysburg sesquicentennial, the high watermark of Civil War remembrance. Instead, we'll hear a lot about Joshua Chamberlain's heroism and Lincoln's hallowing of the Union dead. It's hard to argue with the Gettysburg Address, but in recent years, historians have rubbed much of the luster from the Civil War. Should we consecrate a war that killed and maimed over 1 million Americans? Or should we question, as many have in recent conflicts, whether this was really a war of necessity that justified its appalling costs? "We've decided the Civil War is a good war because it destroyed slavery," says historian Fitzhugh Brundage. "I think it's an indictment of 19th century Americans that they had to slaughter each other to do that." Similar reservations were voiced by an earlier generation of historians known as revisionists. From the 20s to the 40s, they argued that the war was not an inevitable clash. Rather, it was a needless bloodbath, the fault of blundering statesmen and pious cranks, mainly abolitionists. World War II undercut this anti-war stance. Nazism was an evil that had to be fought. So too was slavery, which revisionists, many of them white Southerners, had cast as a relatively benign institution and dismissed as a genuine source of sectional conflict. Historians who came of age during the Civil Rights Movement placed slavery and emancipation at the center of the Civil War. The Civil War today is generally seen as a necessary and emboldening sacrifice, redeemed by the liberation of 4 million slaves. But cracks in this consensus are appearing with growing frequency. Historian David Goldfield states that the war was America's greatest failure. He goes on to impeach politicians, extremists, and the influence of evangelical Christianity for polarizing the nation to the point where compromise or reasoned debate became impossible. Unlike the revisionist of old, Goldfield sees slavery as the bedrock of the Southern cause, and abolition as the war's great achievement. But he also argues that white supremacy was so entrenched, North and South, that war and Reconstruction could never deliver true racial justice to freed slaves, who soon became subject to economic peonage, black codes, Jim Crow, and rampant lynching. Nor did the war knit the nation back together. Instead, the South became a stagnant backwater, a resentful region that lagged and resisted the nation's progress. It would take a century in the civil rights struggle for blacks to achieve legal equality and for the South to emerge from poverty and isolation. Emancipation and reunion, the two great results of this war, were badly compromised, Goldfield said. Given these equivocal gains and the immense toll in blood and treasure, he asked, was the war worth it? No. Few contemporary scholars go as far as Goldfield, but others are challenging key tenets of the current orthodoxy. Historian Gary Gallagher argues that the long-reigning emphasis on slavery and liberation distorts our understanding of the war and of how Americans thought in the 1860s. There is an Appomattox syndrome. We look at Northern victory and emancipation and read the evidence backwards, Gallagher says. Very few Northerners went to war seeking or anticipating the destruction of slavery. They fought for union, and the Emancipation Proclamation was a means to that end, a desperate measure to undermine the South and save a democratic nation that Lincoln called the last best hope of earth. Gallagher also feels that hindsight has dimmed recognition of how close the Confederacy came to achieving its aims. For the South, a tie was as good as a win, he says. It needed to inflict enough pain to convince a divided Northern public that defeating the South wasn't worth the cost. This nearly happened at several points. As late as the summer of 1864, staggering casualties and the stalling of Union armies brought a collapse in Northern morale, cries for a negotiated peace, and the expectation that anti-war and anti-black Democrats would take the White House. The fall of Atlanta that September narrowly saved Lincoln and sealed the South's eventual surrender. Alan Guelzo, director of Civil War Studies at Gettysburg College, adds the Pennsylvania battle to the roster of near misses for the South. He identifies points where Lee's army came within minutes of breaking the Union line. If it had, he believes the already demoralized Army of the Potomac would have gone to pieces. With a victorious Southern army on the loose threatening Northern cities, it would have been game over for the Union. Recent scholarship has also cast new light on the scale and horror of the nation's sacrifice. Soldiers in the 1860s didn't wear dog tags. The burial site of most was unknown, and casualty records were sketchy and often lost. Those tallying the dead in the late 19th century relied on estimates and assumptions to arrive at a figure of 618,000, a toll that seemed etched in stone until just a few years ago. But J. David Hacker, a demographic historian, has used census records to revise the toll upward by 20% to an estimated 750,000, a figure that has won wide acceptance from Civil War scholars. If correct, the Civil War claimed more lives than all other American wars combined, and the increase in population since 1860 means that a comparable war today would cost 7.5 million lives. This horrific toll doesn't include the more than 500,000 soldiers who were wounded and often permanently disabled by amputation, lingering disease, psychological trauma, and other inflictions. Veterans themselves rarely dwelled on this suffering, at least in their writing, nor did many historians who cited the numbing totals of dead and wounded, but rarely delved into the carnage or its societal impact. That's changed dramatically with pioneering studies such as Drew Gilpin Faust's This Republic of Suffering, a 2008 examination of the work of death in the Civil War. killing, dying, burying, mourning, counting. Civil War history has traditionally had a masculine view, said Faust. It's all about general and statesmen and glory. From reading the letters of women during the war, though, she sensed the depth of Americans' fear, grief, and despair. Writing her book amid the daily drumbeat of loss in coverage of Iraq and Afghanistan, Faust's focus on the horrors of the earlier war was reinforced. When we go to war, we ought to understand the costs, she says. Human beings have an extraordinary capacity to forget that. Americans went into the Civil War imagining glorious battle, not gruesome disease and dismemberment. Other historians have exposed the savagery and extent of the war that raged far from the front lines, including guerrilla attacks, massacres of Indians, extrajudicial executions, and atrocities against civilians, some 50,000 of whom may have died as a result of this conflict. There's a violence within and around the Civil War that doesn't fit the conventional heroic narrative, says Brundage. When you incorporate these elements, the war looks less like a conflict over lofty principles and more like a cross-societal bloodletting. In other words, it looks rather like ongoing wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan, which have influenced today's scholars and also their students. It's very hard to see how emancipation might have been achieved by means other than war. Slaveholders resisted any infringement to their right to human property. Lincoln, among many others, advocated the gradual and compensated emancipation of slaves. This had been done in the British West Indies and would later end slavery in Brazil and Cuba. Economists have calculated that the cost of the Civil War, estimated at over $10 billion in 1860 dollars, would have been more than enough to buy the freedom of every slave, purchase them land, and even pay reparations. But Lincoln's proposals for compensated emancipation fell on deaf ears. Nor is there much credible evidence that the South's peculiar institution would have peacefully waned on its own. Slave-grown cotton was booming in 1860, and slaves in non-cotton states like Virginia were being sold to Deep South planters at record prices or put to work on railroads and in factories. Most historians believe that without the Civil War, slavery would have endured for decades, possibly generations. Though emancipation was a byproduct of the war, not its aim, and white Americans clearly failed during Reconstruction to protect and guarantee the rights of freed slaves, the post-war amendments enshrined the promise of full citizenship and equality in the Constitution for later generations to fulfill. This suggests that the 150th anniversary of the Civil War is too narrow a lens through which to view the conflict. We are commemorating the 4 years of combat, but Iraq and Afghanistan remind us that the aftermath of war matters as much as its initial outcome. Though Confederate armies surrendered in 1865, white Southerners fought on by other means, wearing down a war-weary North that was ambivalent about, if not hostile to, black equality. If we focus on the run-up to war when Lincoln pledged to not interfere with slavery in the South, or include the 1870s when the nation abandoned Reconstruction, the story of the Civil War is not uplifting. But that also is an arbitrary and insufficient frame. In 1963, a century after Gettysburg, Martin Luther King Jr. invoked Lincoln's words and the legacy of the Civil War in calling on the nation to pay its promissory note to black Americans, which it finally did in part by passing civil rights legislation that affirmed and enforced the amendments of the 1860s. In some respects, the struggle for racial justice and for national cohesion continues still. From the distance of 150 years, Lincoln's transcendent vision at Gettysburg of a new birth of freedom seems premature. But he himself acknowledged the limits of remembrance. Rather than simply consecrate the dead with words, he said, "It is for us, the living, to rededicate ourselves to the unfinished work of the Civil War. And that takes us to the part of the magazine entitled Talking Points, and we have this article, Cars, Is America's Romance Coming to an End? Has America passed peak driving, said Elizabeth Rosenthal in the New York Times. The United States was once famous for its car culture, the home of Motor City, drive-through movies, and hot rods, where young folk dreamed of getting their kicks on Route 66. But America's love affair with its vehicles seems to be cooling. The number of miles driven overall in the U.S. has dropped 9% since it peaked in 2005, and among 16 to 34-year-olds, it's dropped 23%. The big question, of course, is why, said William O'Connor in the DailyBeast.com. The simple answer is that to the millennial generation, cars no longer have a magic aura of freedom and power. College-educated kids are now obsessed with smartphones and other tech devices rather than Mustangs and Camaros. In the urban enclaves of Brooklyn, San Francisco, and Austin, to which young people are flocking, a car is both unnecessary and too expensive. This is not a new argument, said Alex Taylor III in Fortune.com. Ever since the gasoline crisis of 1973, cynics have predicted that America would turn its back on the automobile. But the numbers tell a different story. Monthly car sales reached a five-year high in June for both large automakers and green car manufacturers such as Tesla. While millennials have been slow to take up driving, economists say they are beginning to enter the market now that the economy is improving. Drivers age 55 and over, meanwhile, are buying new cars by the millions. Despite a brief recessionary slowdown, America's car culture is alive and well. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen at again same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Services wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, Triangle Reading Service, that's one word, .org. If you have questions or comments, please don't hesitate to contact us at 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.